Hi, I'm George Capanelli. Welcome to Age Nation Radio Magazine, where people, passion, and purpose meet.
And I'm Alan Huttner. We're your hosts at this place where boomers, elders, and engaged members of younger generations come to listen, learn, and participate in creating a lifestyle revolution. We present in-depth interviews with world-class experts and authors, provocative commentaries, humorous and informative special features, all interspersed with some great music and more.
Today, as the world around us continues to rant and rage about budget cuts and deficits, we're going to talk about wealth, real wealth. What is it? How do we measure it? Who has it and who doesn't? And what each of us can do to change this picture. We're also going to look at wealth and its impact on this shift in consciousness that's trying to happen. And we're going to look at the possibility that unless we redefine wealth, we may stay trapped in this climate of fear and scarcity that has us in its grips, rather than move to a different state of consciousness where there's well-being and abundance, not just for some of us, but for all of us. You'll also sit in on the next part of a fascinating interview that Alan and his associate, Levi Ben Shmuel, did with economist David Corton.
We have music interludes with Bruce Springsteen, Bob Dylan, Jennifer Warren, and we'll also engage a bit of levity to balance the intensity of our content with Steve Behrman's Cosmic Humor. Today on Happiness and the Levitational Pull.
So welcome to Age Nation Radio Magazine, the place for people who are committed to living consciously and aging wisely in the 21st century. So let's talk about wealth. What is it? How do we measure it? Who has it? Who doesn't? And why at this extraordinary moment in history, when we have it literally in our power to change the future, we are spending so much of our time talking about, worrying about, and fighting over money? To even the casual observer, it's clear there's a war going on. It's not a military war. It's a wealth war. A raid on one side, those who have it, at least wealth defined in the narrowest of terms, and on the other, those who do not. Not surprising. After all, money, having a lot of it, has been the key to power, at least since the dawn of the agrarian age. Remember the golden rule? He who has the gold or the land, access to water or food, rules. At least that's how the game's been played throughout most of recorded history.
Wealth has always been synonymous with power. But since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution, economic wealth and money has come to primarily displace all other forms of wealth. Yes, money, originally backed by gold and now supposedly backed by gold, I don't know, is the primary means we use to determine value, especially in the U.S. and the so-called developing countries. As a result, those who control the money and assets, not even necessarily gold, for the most part, bankers and those Christ ranted upon, the money changers, make a financial killing by loaning out money based on the fractional reserve system, which still takes a PhD plus to understand, and then they charge interest of varying degrees to make the millions or billions. This, in a nutshell, is how wealth is made and debt accumulated. Today, of course, the money changers are no longer satisfied with this tried and true formula. Today, they perform complex financial sleights of hand that substantially increase their profit and dramatically increase our debt.
Those who doubt the significance of this wealth war need only look at what is happening today in the Arab world, where the disenfranchised are throwing off the yoke of the ruling parties who've subjugated them for so long.
You know, George, I was astounded to hear that the poverty level in Egypt was around 40%. Do we need to see this country decline to that level before the demonstrations begin here?
I don't know. In some ways, I think it already has, you know, because when you see the struggle that's being played out on both the streets and in the legislatures in Wisconsin and Ohio and other states, as well as in Washington. The war cry is financial responsibility, and those on the right and the left are vying to either eliminate or defend policies that have been in place for decades that have kept at least a semblance of balance between those who have and those who don't. Why now? Well, according to Mother Jones in March, in their March issue, over the past 30 years, a huge share of wealth has gone to the top 100th of 1% of Americans, who now make an average, listen, $27 million per household. Do you know what the average income is for the bottom 90%? $31,244. Amazing. $27 million per household in the top 100th of 1% versus $31,244 in the bottom 90%.
You know, you're saying $31,244 in the bottom 90%, and that's not even broken out. I mean, what is the bottom 45%?
I don't have that number, but I got to tell you, if all of this isn't enough to wake even Ichabod Crane up, a recent study by Michael Norton of the Harvard Business School found that most Americans aren't even aware this dramatic redistribution of financial wealth has occurred. I think we could say goodnight, Irene. Huh?
I wish we had this song to play here. All right. As long as we allow this war of wealth to be waged under the banner of fiscal responsibility, as long as we continue to define wealth only in terms of money, we believe our nation will continue its inevitable slide towards insolvency. What's wrong with practicing fiscal responsibility and people getting rich? Isn't that the purpose of the game? Either have money or you don't. End of story. Well, we don't believe it's the whole story. I don't think you believe it's the whole story. Now, George doesn't believe it's the whole story. Instead, we believe the reason we are in so much trouble today is that we are living within a very narrow and distorted definition of wealth in the hands of a few.
But how else can wealth be measured, and what would a redefinition of wealth accomplish? We believe it would bring a balance and sanity back into life here in the 21st century. How? What do you think would happen if we defined wealth in terms of wisdom or the strength and viability of our infrastructure instead of just money? What if wealth was measured by the quality of our lives and what we contribute rather than how much we make or how much we consume? By the kind of relationships we have and the amount of integrity, honesty, and individual empowerment each of us demonstrates. You see, in a world where God, the God of economics, is worshipped so exclusively, everything else gets devalued.
We know some of you are thinking we are just fuzzy-headed and naive. After all, one can't convert intangibles like wisdom, integrity, and quality of life into tangibles like food, shelter, and clothing. Is that true? Let's look. Over the last 40 years, we have disassembled our manufacturing infrastructure, shipped jobs overseas, decimated our skilled workforce, and almost eliminated the middle class. As a result of these things and special tax breaks and incentives given to the few, we've seen an unprecedented transfer of wealth upward to those who do not contribute anything of lasting value to our way of life.
So if we redefined wealth, we think those who are currently abusing the system for their own selfish gains will be seen for who they are and what they're doing. For an example, how many times have we heard the old cliche that money can't buy love? What about health, integrity, self-respect, honor? Can money buy these things? We know wealth does not protect us from aging and death, and that having it will not matter much if our habitat is no longer habitable. In a world constantly at war over money, money will not keep us safe either. Just ask Mubarak or Gaddafi.
So, we invite you to image a world in which wealth is not measured by the amount of money we make or how much we consume, but by the value we contribute, the energy and resources we replenish, and what we create to pass on to future generations and the greater population.
We invite you to image a world in which we remember that we have it in our power in this very moment in history to create a future that's brighter than the past, a future that's more stable, peaceful, and one in which the majority of us are not required to spend this precious gift called life in servitude to those who already have far more than they need.
Age Nation Radio. Love, laugh, enjoy life.
Recently, Alan and Levy had a chance to talk with David Corton, author of Agenda for a New Economy. As we said last week, we believe you'll find David's ideas provocative and helpful in the national dialogue on the state of our economy. I think you'll find it also helpful as to what we need to do actually, rather than putting a Band-Aid on our problems to fix things.
We have returned with our featured guest today, David Corton, on the line. He is the author of Agenda for a New Economy, From Phantom Wealth to Real Wealth. That's his newest book. He's also written The Great Turning, The Post-Corporate World, and When Corporations Rule the World. And we may get into the problem with corporations a little later on in your 12-point program for the Agenda for a New Economy, but Levy wants to return back to GDP and kind of clarify that for our audience, because we've thrown that around a few times. And Levy, why don't you take over?
Thanks, Alan. You know, David, we've been talking about this economic system that is very broken and needs to be replaced. And the economic models and the indicators that show us how well it's doing are part of the problem. GDP in particular, gross domestic product, it's a very limited way to measure the overall health of an economy. So for our audience, could you define GDP? Tell us what it is, how it's used, and what could replace it.
Yeah, basically it's a measure of throughput through the economy. As you noted earlier, the rate at which we take useful resources, process them through some set of procedures, do our consumption, and then throw them away. Now, you know, going back to this idea of a spaceship economy, Kenneth Boulding pointed out the distinction between managing to maximize flows versus maximizing stocks. GDP measures flow, the faster things move through the economy. And, of course, the focus on GDP leads to the focus on creating planned obsolescence so that things don't last very long, so that we have to replace them. It counts the extraction and conversion of natural wealth, natural resources into garbage as a plus. The faster we cut down our trees, the faster we strip the fish out of the oceans, the faster the throughput, and the greater the illusion that we're getting richer. Now, Boulding's idea of maximizing stocks is maximizing well-being, maximizing indicators of our human health, maximizing indicators of the size and health of our forests, of our fisheries, measures of the health of our children. It's really maintaining the stocks from an economic perspective that is the true measure of our well-being, which, you know, in the spaceship, that becomes very clear. You are very conscious of, you know, what is your stock of energy, what is your stock of water, of air, and you manage everything to maintain those stocks, not to maximize their use and throughput. particularly throwing them away outside of the spaceship, or otherwise rendering them into a condition that they are unsuited for reuse.
You know, David, this reminds me of the one thing you also point out in the book, which is underlying all of this, there is a moral crisis in our society, and it seems like up till recently, one of the great American rights is to has been to use something and then just throw it away.
Yeah, it is very much a crisis of values, and in many ways, it is ultimately a spiritual issue.
Yeah.
And the, you know, actually I don't have it right in front of me, but I, you know, sometimes in my talks I refer to the, you know, the biblical phrase from the Sermon on the Mount that no one can serve two masters. You know, we either serve God or Mammon, and Mammon, of course, refers to the worship of money, and that you know, that becomes the foundation of our problem. If we you know, I think of God as spirit. You know, and money is a diversion from spirit, and that's exactly what we've done in our economy. We are, you know, we're destroying life. We're destroying the manifestation of the spirit of creation. You know, all to create these illusionary numbers, the phantom wealth that or mammon that we have become focused on. Also, you know. Also, note, you know, this, we've been carrying out a test of a social experiment of the idea that there is no common good, there is no public good, there's only individual interests, and that we all do best when we each pursue our own individual greed and financial advantage, and we now have the results of that, and. You know, surprise, it turns out that Jesus was right. We have to care about each other.
He really did know something.
We have to be responsible.
No.
You know, it's really embarrassing from a species standpoint to recognize that we have been so befuddled for so many years you know, forgotten that absolutely fundamental truth.
Yeah, this is very important, David, and you know, we talked a little bit about it off mic. And in fact, there are some scientists. I mentioned Amit Goswami. There's other scientists who are pointing out that this quantum field that we're all part of is impacted by everything we do, and we're all connected, even to the extent that we are all one energetic, call it spirit or call it divine intelligence, even though our egos get in the way and we kind of forget that we are part of the whole and we like to think of ourselves as separate. This is where the greed part comes in, and we get caught up in that. And we were talking about the Forbes magazine, 1,200 and some billionaires. I mean, how many millionaires have been created just in the last, you know, 20 years because they've been caught up in not the spirit, but in the material, and that we have to return to this spirit. And I think that's a great lead in to going from GDP to other indices that we need to create. And how realistic is it to pick up on what you write about in the book? The new Economics Foundation in London has a Happy Planet Index. I know it's kind of like sounds kind of new agey, but the components of the HPI and some of the ideal inclusions that you suggest for an index, you know, on page 99 of the book, I think we need to do this. Now, you know, speak a little bit about those components, and is it unrealistic to ask that our government, our elected officials, our Congress, and even if our economists don't want to do it, we can certainly have the president, the administrative branch of our government, the legislative branch of our government, rule on this one and say, no, we're going to look at another index. What, speak about that.
Yeah. I mean, there's certainly no reason why we can't change our index, irrespective of what the economists may think. Now that you mentioned the Happy Planet Index, which you know, I think conceptually is one of the better models I've seen, and it you know, in the numerator it has life expectancy, which is you know, kind of a crude measure of our physical health and well-being. The other fact element in the numerator is the is essentially happiness. It's you know, derived from surveys of you know, how do people describe themselves in terms of their sense of happiness and well-being, which in a way is a a kind of measure of our mental health. And so,
or psychological or spiritual.
Psychological health, yeah.
Yeah, spiritual health.
Spiritual health.
Yeah.
And then in the denominator is the ecological footprint, which is a measure of the kind of amount of healthy, productive environmental space we need to support whatever our level of consumption is. And so the... You know, what comes out as the goal then is to maximize our physical and psychological health while minimizing our ecological footprint or our burden on the planet. And, I think that brings together the essential elements in a very powerful way. And, of course, if we measured, assessed our economic performance against that kind of measure, we would make very, very different decisions.
And without getting into, you know, statistics or mathematics, which would still be good to do at some point in the near future for people who need the numbers or the science to corroborate what probably most of us know, is the quality of life has deteriorated in spite of all this accumulated wealth.
Yeah, and I think most people are aware of that.
Yeah,
that we have less of our healthy natural environment. The air in many places is polluted. We seem to be drinking mostly bottled water because we don't trust our natural water sources any longer. And but I think most of all is the destruction of community, the destruction of human ties, a sense of mutual caring that has played out as we have destroyed our local economies, destroyed our community meeting places, as everything has become privatized and commodified.
Yeah, that is a perfect lead into a paragraph from the book that I wanted to read. The title of this section is called "The New Economy is a Living Economy," and you write, "Because the most important forms of real wealth are living wealth, the term living economy is a synonym for a real wealth economy that mimics the organization of a healthy ecosystem. The measure of a living economy's wealth is the vitality or creative life energy embodied in its people, relationships, and natural environment." So can you speak about this culture of a living economy and what one's responsibility is to that?
Well, it of course comes back, as you note, to the recognition of our interdependence, and it is so stunning that our modern physics, our quantum physics, has moved so far from the simplistic models of Newtonian physics and the idea that that everything is the only reality is matter and mechanism, and that the whole of creation is a process of a combination of mechanics and chance, to the quantum physics, which creates a picture of a dynamic flow in which the only relationships are actually real. And everything is interconnected. It gives us a totally different kind of frame, and yet so much of our kind of public culture and certainly our economics is grounded in the old Newtonian physics, which is totally out of date.
Yeah.
And one of the things that's been so striking to me and very influential was when I discovered the new biology and the biologist who study life on its own terms rather than trying to impose Newtonian or Darwinian models on it, and who come out recognizing that life is an exquisitely cooperative activity.
Reclaim your passion. Age Nation Radio. Come back to the revolution. Age Nation Radio.
Again, Alan, just a really terrific interview that you and Levy did with David. I just find that he speaks with such measured intelligence, you know?
Yeah, I really like him. I think I might have said this the last time, but there's something about the sweetness of somebody's soul. You can tell that they're talking from a deep heart place and they're knowing as opposed to their believing.
Yeah, it's – and so, you know, when he takes on this whole conversation about GDP or gross domestic product. Powerful stuff.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad he went into detail, or we asked him to define it. It used to be GNP, gross national product. I don't know what the difference is between national and domestic, but this idea that that we measure success, economic growth, by using up resources and consuming in excess and depleting our planetary whole, which he brought in. He referred to the spaceship metaphor, and I don't even know if he talked about the spaceship and Bucky Fuller's principles that he wrote about. I know you're old enough to know Bucky Fuller.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to know Bucky Fuller. And the metaphor is, you know, when you do the spaceship concept, everything has to be in order, in the right place, limited consumption, and what do you do with the waste? And he said, we're on a spaceship. That's what the Earth is. But we haven't realized how to handle that.
Yeah, and, you know, if a spaceship only measured what he calls throughput, right? I mean, if the success of our economy is determined by how quickly we burn through our national resources, mm-hmm. how quickly we use what's at our disposal, then obviously the tank is going to run dry pretty quickly, you know?
You know, this brings up something he mentioned about planned obsolescence.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, I remember when I was doing advanced economics in my going for my master's degree, and this came up in the discussion like it was a good thing because, you know, you'd use something up and then people would have to buy more of it. And this is still going on in our society. I mean, we could make better things to last longer if we really put our engineering and creative abilities to it.
Well, actually, I'd say it even differently.
Okay.
think we could make things better and last longer if we stopped using the engineering that's building planned obsolescence into these things. Because, you know, it's so strange to be living in a world in which these two concepts, planned obsolescence and sustainability, are right side by side. It's like the past and the future rubbing up against one another constantly. And what we end up with is a legislature and a Congress that fights the idea of sustainability because everybody who's putting money in their pocket is in favor of planned obsolescence.
Hey, look, I have a real case example here. Going to a car dealership because the transmission in my – and I'll say it, Olds Intrigue, a GM product of around 2000. And everybody in the store knows about their transmission problems. And I said to the sales guy, I said, well, you know, why is that? And he said, planned obsolescence, which is not necessarily built in some of the finer, let's say, European or Japanese cars. Maybe we're headed that way now. I don't know. But, you know, we need to end this planned obsolescence economic theory.
Well, and I don't think it. You know, I don't think it's an American problem. I think it's a world problem. I think in electronics and components and all kinds of things, we find consistently that the end of the product is built into the beginning of it. So I think we really need to get to a place, and David talked about it, where we really come back again to this conversation of the commons, the common good, versus this madness that people talk about, the free economy. It has never worked. It only works as well as the intelligence and ethics of the people who are operating it. And clearly, in our age, both the intelligence and ethics of those people need to be questioned.
Would you say that market-driven and greed are two sides of the same coin?
Yeah, and it's tough, though. You know, I mean, we can't certainly pull the plug on the whole economy, but we have to slowly begin to re-educate, and I think schools are beginning to do that in the concepts of sustainability. Mm-hmm. We have to re-educate future generations that what we leave behind is as important, if not more important, than what we use during our lifetimes.
I don't remember the guest his name a while back that, you know, I was interviewing, but he introduced the term. He says, neither one of them by themselves, neither one of the isms, capitalism or socialism, by themselves work. We need to have social capitalism, whatever that is. That's another discussion.
It is indeed.
Thanks. Well, it's that time where George and I have with us on our Age Nation line, our Age Nation aging sage and guru, Swami Beyondananda. Always a pleasure. Swami, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Today, Swami, we're going to talk about how to enjoy every precious moment of life. You seem pretty happy, Swami. What are your secrets?
Well, I'm happy to tell you, and because I'm happy all the time, I would be just as happy if I didn't tell you. But in our materialistic society, people learn that they are not enough to be being just being themselves, that if they only had this or they only had that, then they would be happy. And sad to say, many people are jealous of others who they think might be happier than they are. You know what Sigmund Freud called this, don't you?
I don't know. What did he call it?
He called it happiness envy. That's when you're concerned that somebody's happiness might be bigger than your own. But if you bring your happiness with you all times, you will never be without it, right?
Right. You know, I have always been amazed at how some people can remain happy regardless of their circumstances.
Yes, me too, and I will tell you a story. Remember Alfred Kinsey and the Kinsey Report?
Sure. Wasn't that back in the 40s or 50s he did all those surveys about human sexuality?
Well, exactly. And Kinsey was conducting his survey, and he came upon one man who looked like he was glowing from the inside out. And Kinsey had never met a happier individual. So he asked him the question, how frequently do you have sex? And the man replied, once every 6 years. Well, Kinsey was very impressed. He said, my goodness, you only have sex once every 6 years, and you look so happy. Why is that? And the man said, because tonight's the night.
Well, it's like the comedians say, timing is everything. Any other secrets for staying happy?
Well, now here's something very interesting. Science tells us that we don't laugh or smile because we're happy. We are happy because we laugh and smile. See, even if you don't feel like it, if you turn the corners of your mouth upward in a smile, your body thinks you're happy and produces happiness hormones. So you have your own happiness generator.
So you mean if we just turn the corners of our mouths up in a smile, the body chemistry changes for the better?
Yes, I call it feeling the levitational pull. Listen, you want to uplift humankind? Start by uplifting your own face.
Well, Swami, we're just about out of time for today. Namaste, Swami.
Namaste and namasgo. Goodbye.
As you know, each week we do our best to bring you a few items from the week's news that, from our standpoint, demonstrate just how bizarre and confused our world sometimes can be. We call this segment, You've Got to Be Kidding. So this week, the Center for Responsive Politics reports people with average family incomes of $120,000 per year, which is pretty high considering where our world is today, have
certainly above that 90% that we talked about earlier.
It's true. Huh? Have 1 in 22 chance of becoming millionaires. Members of Congress, however, who have a medium income of $912,000 per year, have a 1 in 2 chance of becoming millionaires. No surprise, of course, that the wealthiest members of Congress voted 100% to extend the tax breaks to the rich.
You know, I'm going to throw something in here. You know, we talk about like teacher salary and the quality of education, and that's so low. I think if we lowered the salary of our congressional representatives, we might get better people. And
it's certainly possible. So here's another one. Princeton political scientist Larry Bartels studies the voting behaviors of U.S. senators. One study in the early 90s especially discovered that senators respond far more to the desires of high-income groups than to anyone else. Surprise, surprise. He found that Republicans don't respond at all to the desires of voters with modest incomes. But what should surprise us is that Bartels found that Democratic senators don't respond to the desires of these voters either. So
you got to be kidding.
Yeah, you indeed. You got to be kidding.
I'm shocked. No, I'm not. I knew that. But did you know that?
Yes, I did.
And here's one I've been ranting about for years. The average CEO pay in the U.S. is now more than 185 times that of the average worker, and in some cases as high as 500 times more. What exactly do these folks do that is worth that much money? And speaking of high incomes and taxes, effective tax rates for heads of households earning $1 million a year from non-investment dollars was 55.3% under Lyndon Johnson. Today it's 32.4%. And we wonder why we are having a budget crisis. I'd like to know the revenue that be generated from the difference. Because, you know, you got to be kidding.
Stop waiting. Now's the time. Age Nation Radio. Age Nation Radio. Our revolution is now.
And now here's Alan with a commentary on Earth Changes in 2012 by Sal Rakeli and the founders.
All right. So the first section towards the end of the book where these Earth changes are explained is how they're going to affect us, because we're talking about astronomical, astrological things. We know that the times are accelerating and there are Earth changes happening. So first, under sociological changes, in order to change society significantly, there are two methods. One, initiate a massive program of real education, teach courses in public and private schools on what it means to be a human being, teach people to think for themselves, aka critical thinking, structure the society in such a way that teachers are valued and paid to reflect the contribution they make to society. This channel, they're talking about Sal and the founders, once remarked that the loser in a heavyweight prize fight lasting a few minutes makes more money than a teacher does in a lifetime. Restructure your priorities to make education and open-mindedness imperative. The alternative is, number two, create a situation where people are forced to change, such as massive series of earth changes that jerk people out of their consumer-induced stupor. If the store shelves are bare because the crops are under the sea or the banks have no money, the whole charade comes to a screaming halt. This is obviously not a very eloquent way of waking up the populace, but it can be quite effective, and it is the most likely scenario at the present time. I will add, I'm hoping we do the first thing, and that'll change things in a positive way. Jumping ahead to a section on economics, it says, as the Earth continues to accelerate in her evolution and the vibrational frequencies increase, this affects consciousness, the thought forms and desires of the light workers on Earth will become magnified. As detailed in the psychology section of this book, a rising vibratory frequency automatically brings to the surface of consciousness all that has been suppressed, repressed, and denied. Some souls will be able to withstand this rapid, intense cleansing, while others will be unprepared and unable to cope with the purification necessary in order to evolve. Many of the corrupt systems in place on your world will be brought to light in a similar manner, and it will be quite painful for most of humanity to face these demons in their midst. One such system involves your economics. That's what they're talking about. As detailed in many of your alternative economic writings, you have a system that is called fractional reserve banking. We talked about that earlier, in which money is printed and distributed in such a way as to cause the financial assets of the banks to be replaced with real assets, meaning that paper is exchanged for things that have real value in your world, such as houses, lands, crops, etc. Banks print and then loan these fictional assets, paper money, to borrowers. It's all not working. And I'm just going to slow down here. I'm going to recommend the book because he gets into the impending medical crisis, which we may get into and talk about healthcare, the energy crisis, the disappearing natural resources. Remember the Bucky Fuller spaceship model. And what are solutions that we need to do to change these people who attach to the second alternative as opposed to education and waking people up? So our thanks to Sal Rakeli and the founders.
And thanks, Alan. That was, you know, especially with everything that we talked about today, a really nice way to remind us all that, you know, we either pay now or we pay later, as that old commercial used to say, you know.
Or in spite of what we think we are, everything is evolving. Are we going to get on the same page of evolving at the higher rate of frequency, or are we going to resist and scream and fight against it?
Yeah. Well, we're going to see, because as they say, we are living in interesting times, you know. So next week, we're going to look at some of the things each of us, all by ourselves, each of us, can do to help create the shift from scarcity and fear to a condition of abundance and well-being. As always, we're interested in your comments about the show and about any topics you'd like us to explore. Send your recommendations to info@agenation.com. You can also find out a lot more about AgeNation and all of the things we do at AgeNation.com, where you can sign up for some of the great free offers and PDFs and audio programs and whatnot that we make available. And you can follow us, of course, on Facebook and Twitter.
Elizabeth Rose here, co-producer of the thought-provoking and life-enhancing TransitionsTeleseminars.com series, inviting you to listen to prominent guests conversing on love, spirituality, money, sexuality, and the mystical. This series is hosted by your Age Nation Radio Magazine co-host, Alan Huttner, and his good friend, Bill O'Hanlon, psychotherapist, best-selling author, and featured Oprah guest. Guest presenters include Marianne Williamson, Andrew Harvey, Joan Borisenko, Bruce Lipton, Larry Dossey, Harville Hendricks, and many more. A lot of great content available, MP3 audio downloads, PDF transcripts, CEU credits, and free conversations with bonus materials. Go to www.transitionsteleseminars.com for more information.
Over 40 and looking for answers to the challenges and remarkable opportunities ahead. Are you under 40 and want to know more about the world you'll soon inherit? Then Do Not Go Quietly is the perfect book for you. Inspiring, empowering, full of practical guidance, this best-selling book has already won 3 2013 book awards. It is a powerful call to action into a life of genuine purpose for those who weren't born yesterday. Wise woman Jean Houston says it's profound, compassionate, and deeply useful. So live the life you were born to live, and remember, you're never too old or too young to live your dreams. Available on Amazon.com, at Barnes & Noble, and bookstores everywhere. For free downloads, interviews, and a lot more, visit donotgoquietlythebook.com.
The best is yet to come. Age Nation Radio.